So it's basically the idea is that in general, you have some polarization field that you look out and you're measuring polarization at every spot in the sky. And that's basically a headless vector. And then you need some way to write down that field. So at every point, there's some orientation to the polarization. And a general way you can do it is in terms of either E modes or B modes, which says, is the direction of that the polarization is changing, is it aligned or perpendicular to the direction of the polarization? And B modes are tipped over by 45 degrees. And so you can imagine you go to any point in the sky and you say, which way is the polarization changing? Measure that polarization direction. If it's either at 90 degrees or parallel, then you declare that to be an E mode of some kind. And if it's at 45 degrees, then you throw that into your B mode bin. And that's how you can make a map of E modes and B modes on the sky. And it's all built in terms of gradients of the polarization field on the sky. So in general, this isn't a particularly interesting way of doing things, because in general, you would just throw some random field up there and you'll get as many E modes as you do B modes. But the reason it becomes interesting is when you're sourcing this from, Good. I just threw these at the front of my galaxy clustering slides that we'd be able to say. And so the transformation from Q and U to E and B are just in terms of cosines and sines in some limit of Fourier modes instead of spherical harmonics. Yep.
How do they get the axes? I mean, like if you rotate your E modes, they have E modes, right?
Well, that's the thing, is that it's true for Q and U, because Q and U is a measurement of up and down versus side to side polarization. But for these E modes, you define your axis by, you can do it two ways. You can either say, which way is it changing? So in this case, you see that it's changing in this direction. And what you're looking for is the direction of polarization as compared to the direction that it changes. And so it defines this natural basis to work in, which is entirely defined by the field itself. And so it's completely coordinate independent at that point. And you really just have to be looking at the direction that things are changing compared to the polarization orientation. So it's a nice way of working with things that doesn't involve coordinates. Now, when you do an experiment, your experiment actually has coordinates. So when you do an experiment, you almost always are going to measure it in some coordinate basis that you then have to transform into this Q and U, into E and B, but that's okay. So in the language of spin of spherical harmonics, there are these things called spin one and spin two spherical harmonics, which you just derive by doing derivatives of the regular old spherical harmonics. If you just do covariant derivatives on the sphere of spherical harmonics, you end up with these spin-weighted spherical harmonics, and you can, as many derivatives as you take, you're just taking more and more, that's a higher and higher spin weight. And spin two turns out to be the ones that you use for polarization. But it's a basis to expand a polarization field on the sky. So another way to think of it is as a divergence and a curl, and sort of as an analogy with E and M. So this thing right here would be something that has an E mode less than zero. So you could sort of think of that. So while they're headless vectors, it still kind of looks like it's some kind of a divergence. Now, the reason that it's a little bit funny is because this one, yeah, you're sure you look at that and you say, oh yeah, I remember that from E and M. That's like a charge and it's going out like that. But then this is also an E mode, where it's going around in a circle. And my version of E and M is I'm imagining a current loop going around, and those would have little arrows on it, which has a handedness to it. And so to me, that doesn't really seem like, that to me would trigger magnetism and not electricity, but that's okay. But this thing right here is also an E mode. So this is E greater than zero, this is E less than zero. And the key to these things is there's no handedness to them. You can flip them any way you want, and you'll always, and there's a symmetry to it. So there's a left-right symmetry, there's an up-down symmetry. Whereas B modes have this property that, so this would be a B mode. And if you were to reflect it this way, you see that it flips sign. But if you flip this thing this way, you end up looking at something that looks a lot like this. So anything that has some kind of handedness is gonna give you B modes. And if there's no handedness to it, you'll always end up with E modes. So this is why the CMB, if it's sourced entirely by these scalar fluctuations, will only give you E modes, because there's no handedness to some temperature distribution. If you just have this density distribution right here that's causing the microwave background fluctuations, the only thing that you have to work with is that the polarization, the pattern is changing in this direction. But you can't get any handedness to this because there's no second vector here. So in general, you only get E modes from this, from scalar fluctuations in the CMB. So any just pure density fluctuations, anything that you can just write down as you have some field that you just write down some number at every point in space will only ever give you E modes. So this has been measured. So it's been measured extremely well. So here are the recent Planck results on this E mode power spectrum. And you know, just like before with the temperature power spectrum, you see that it's extremely well measured. And Lambda CDM fits this exquisitely well. This is somewhat independent data. So there is some correlation with temperature. This is the temperature polarization cross. This is polarization on its own, but it's new information about the acoustic peaks. And it's still the case that the same six parameters seem to describe everything that we need to know. Well, it's actually impossible to tell which one they're plotting. Because right now the temperature data has vastly higher statistical weight than the polarization data. So whether you've done a joint fit to the polarization data or not, you're completely dominated by the temperature data. So it may be that this is just the fit to the temperature data that's going through the points. Or it could be that they've included the temperature data, they've included the polarization data. But either way, this effectively is using the temperature data to infer what model should go through the points. And it does. So whether you include the polarization data or not, it doesn't really change the fits very much. So the Planck data starts to fall apart out here. So this is the polarization. It starts to fall apart a little bit in that you can actually see scatter in their points once you get out to L of about 2,000. So once you get out to L of 2,000, that's where the ground-based stuff starts to kick in. So SPT poll, this is what we published a few months ago. So our points are the red ones. And you see we have big error bars out here as compared to these Planck ones, which you can't even see their error bars. But by the time you get out to L of 2000, we have these little itty-bitty little error bars. And the reason that we have such smaller error bars is because we have a big telescope. And so the diffraction limit for a 10-meter telescope is going to allow us to push to smaller angular scales. So this is the complementarity that we get. Okay, now, there is a way to get B modes in the CMB, and that's from gravitational waves. So you get them from gravitational waves just because you now have a second thing to play around with, in that not only can you have the gravitational wave that's propagating in this direction, which means it's changing in along this axis right here, but what's happening with a gravitational wave as it goes through space is it's stretching in one direction, compressing in the other one, and there's two different polarizations. It can either be up and down like this, which says you get a compression in one direction and a stretch in the other, or you can tip it over by 45 degrees and you get a compression or a stretch this way and a compression this way, followed by the opposite as it propagates along. And now you have this second vector to play with, and now you can get some handedness. And so depending on exactly what the polarization of the gravitational wave is, if you imagine an electron that's sitting right here and you say, which direction is the intensity quadrupole in the local temperature gonna be? Because when a gravity wave passes through, you see a stretching of space-time above you and a compression beside you, which means you'll see redshifts, and that's a quadrupole. So this electron sees a quadrupole, and then the Thompson scattering from that will give you this polarization. And as that thing propagates, the orientation will change. And so depending on whether this gravitational wave is polarized straight up and down like this or tipped over at 45 degrees, you can either get an E mode or a B mode. And so gravitational waves in general will generate almost equal E and B. Now, so the CMB generates lots of E modes, but it doesn't on its own from these scalar fluctuations generate any B, which means if you look, so you won't be able to see the E modes from gravity waves, but you should be able to just see the B just because there's no background. It's just a question of integrating down until you see them. So why is this interesting? Well, because inflation is supposed to generate both E modes and B modes. So this is the cartoon version of inflation. So you guys presumably heard the real version of inflation. The cartoon version of it is that you spend a lot of time. So this is the energy density in some scalar field versus the scalar field value. And inflation is going on, at any one spot, you're stuck at, up here in some potential, and it's offset from zero. And so if you're offset from zero, then remember that the Hubble constant, you had h squared going as the energy density. Well, this is giving you some energy density. And as long as you're stuck at this spot in the potential, that energy density is constant. So the energy density is constant, which means you just get an accelerating universe, and that's inflation. Now, if it stays up there, then you're stuck in inflation forever. So it has to do some evolution. And as this thing evolves, so what's going to happen is you're going to start moving around in phi space. But it's also true that you're going to have quantum fluctuations in this. And so the quantum fluctuations, what's going to happen, you get these quantum fluctuations, you're jiggling from side to side in phi. As you jiggle from side to side in phi, so imagine you're right here, some quantum fluctuation moves you either up or down, you're changing your local expansion rate. So basically the rate of acceleration in your universe will change slightly as you jiggle from side to side due to these quantum fluctuations. Those changes in the local expansion rate are going to manifest themselves in the end as honest-to-God curvature fluctuations. And that's what generates these curvature fluctuations in the universe that we see around us. And then eventually it ends and it rolls down here. But in general, when you're looking at the curvature fluctuations, all you're seeing is the slope of this field. Because the quantum fluctuations move you side to side. If this thing was completely flat, inflation would never end, but if it's completely flat, it doesn't matter if you're moving side to side. It's completely translationally invariant in this phi. And so there's no information in the scalar fluctuations, or not that much information in the scalar fluctuations, about this overall amplitude. And in the end, all of this energy is going to get dumped into radiation somehow, which means this is the energy scale of inflation is related to this offset right here. On the other hand, when you're up here, in terms of tensors, you basically are just going to get some RMS strain because you have these fluctuations in the gravitational potential, and those are going to directly propagate into gravitational waves. So you basically have potentials getting frozen in on various sizes, and those are going to be proportional to this offset right here. So you get quantum fluctuations in basically the overall scale. And so the RMS strain is just going to go as the horizon size over the Planck length. So your horizon size is jittering around a little bit. You get your RMS strain. And so now it's directly proportional to V of phi. And so that means that the amplitude of the tensors that come out of inflation are directly proportional to this offset, the value of this offset, which is directly telling you the energy scale of inflation. So if you could measure these tensors, it directly tells you what energy inflation happened at. So if it's gut scale inflation, then these tensors should be measurable with basically our current generation of experiments. So not too long ago, BICEP2 measured B modes in the CMB at 150 gigahertz. And so here are their points. And shortly thereafter, some other people did it. So Polar Bear has some measurements of B modes on smaller scale. ActPol has basically some limits, and SPTPol, we put out ours, and we have some measurements of B modes here. Now, this signal right here is what you get from gravitational lensing of E modes. And so we'll talk about that in a second when, well, this afternoon when we talk about gravitational lensing. But basically, imagine what would happen. You have that direction of polarization changing in those E modes. If I take that pattern and I put it through some gravitational shear, which is a, you know, some gradient in gravity, what that's going to do is it's going to take that pattern and it's going to shift the direction that it's changing. But gravitational lensing doesn't change the orientation of the polarization. So you're changing the spatial pattern, but not the polarization orientation, which means you generate B modes that way. And so this is what you would just expect to be generating in terms of B modes. And unfortunately, what this term, what this line is right here, is an estimate of galactic dust in that field from the Planck experiment. And so what you see is that, yes, this is clearly above the expectation from gravitational lensing, but unfortunately, it's almost eerily on top of what you would expect from galactic dust plus gravitational lensing. So it appears that we currently still only have upper limits on B modes. But who knows what'll happen. So people are developing a better understanding of exactly what this curve is supposed to look like. And at the same time, with SPT pole, we're pushing down this way. And bicep 2 and Keck are adding more frequencies, which means they should be able to remove some of this dust contamination. So, and we're looking at timescales of sort of not weeks, probably not months, but definitely on the timescale of a year, we should know a lot more about this stuff.
Is that a reasonable length to explain gravity wave effects? So, or are they, do we expect them at all scales? Or?
So the gravitational wave spectrum is in general only on, is primarily going to be seen on large scales. And that's just because once the gravitational waves come inside the horizon, they redshift away. And so, because they're redshifting away, that means you primarily are going to see them on the scale of the horizon when they come in. So it, and so compared to the temperature anisotropies where the potentials stay roughly constant, that means that the temperature, the tensors are tipped over by sort of an extra factor of, say, the scale factor squared or something like that. So, the BICEP experiment, it looked a lot like B-modes. So if you fit B-modes as a template, it's a perfectly good fit. Okay. All right. So that was the bit that I wanted to finish off just to make sure that we connected the search for B-modes a little bit with inflation so you understand why people are so excited about it. All right. So this is a summary of what I did before, that there's lots going on in the CMB. We're getting better fast. And what we're hoping to do is figure out exactly what the amplitude of the tensor fluctuations are. And from that, we'll get a direct measurement of the energy scale of inflation or whatever it was in the early universe that was generating the fluctuations. So it's, all right. Any questions about CMB? Yep.
What is it about inflation that generates gravitational waves for other theories like that?
It's basically the main thing is just that it's a huge energy scale. So almost anything you do, so what's happening with inflation is if it's happening at the gut scale, you just have something going on at the scale of, so for the gut scale, this number right here would be, so this would be 10 to the 15 GeV or something for gut scale inflation. And it really is just coming down to, well, what's the Planck scale? The Planck scale is where quantum mechanics and gravity are crossing. And it means that if you set up something that had Planck energy, you would expect of order unity gravity waves, gravitational radiation, just, you know, order of magnitude that you're going to have quantum fluctuations, and those quantum fluctuations are going to have the same amplitude as the gravitational ones. So you would expect order unity fluctuations in gravity waves. And then what's going to happen is that the typical strain that you're going to expect is then just going to scale as, okay, so now let's say we're not quite at the Planck scale. So now let's say instead of being at one Schwarzschild radius, now you move out to say 10 Schwarzschild radii. Well, you're still going to get some gravitational wave fluctuations from, and it's now just going to be scaled by the fraction by which you're not quite at the Planck scale anymore. And so the main reason why inflation is giving you this ridiculous, was giving you any gravity waves at all is just because the assumption is that the energy scale is still reasonably close to the Planck scale. So yeah, 10 to the 15 GeV is not the Planck scale, but it's still pretty big. And the scalar fluctuations in the CMB are at the level of 10 to the minus 5. So this is the last little bit that's in the end what saves you is that the scalar fluctuations are 10 to the minus 5, which means you're already starting when you're comparing tensors with scalars at 10 to the minus 5. So that means that you don't have to be all the way up to the Planck scale and still be competitive with the tensors, with the scalars. So I think that probably, unless it was very finely tuned, any theory of the initial conditions of the universe that have something happening at the gut scale would generically give you gravitational radiation at about this level. Now, lots of inflation models are not at the gut scale. So if you did, inflation at a lower energy scale, then you wouldn't expect much in the way of gravitational radiation. So there are lots of inflation models that actually don't predict any measurable level of tensors at all. So it's one of these things where if you see it, it tells you a lot, that it tells you that something interesting happened at the gut scale or just slightly below it as we're pushing down. And inflation seems like the most natural thing. And so once you do that, you can then start saying, well, does the spectrum of scalar fluctuations agree with the spectrum of tensor fluctuations, because as inflation goes on, as you're rolling down this hill, your tensor amplitudes are also going to be changing. And so you have this consistency relation where you would expect your evolution as a function of scale in the tensors to match what you're seeing in the scalars. So it would allow you to actually start probing what's going on in these energies if you detected them.
So you would rule out the low energy.
And you would rule out low energy inflation for sure. You agree with that, Cliff? Okay. Okay, so now we're going to move on to galaxy surveys. And so it's a little bit backwards in that, in fact, we discovered the CMB in 1965, and that told us a lot. But we didn't discover the fluctuations in the CMB beyond the dipole until the 90s. And lots of cosmology happened in the 70s and 80s, and Jim Peebles was extremely busy. He must have been doing something. So what was he doing? Well, he spent a lot of time doing looking at galaxy surveys. And a galaxy survey is sort of, it's a very simple thing. It just says you take some patch of sky. And so I got this patch of sky by just, so you can now go to these archives all over the place and just type in some random coordinates and say, give me an image of the sky. So that's not the way they used to do it, apparently. But that's clearly the easiest way to do it. So this is some random piece of the sky. I couldn't even tell you where it is. And what do you see is you see a bunch of dots, and if some of them are stars, and these ones are almost certainly galaxies. So the very brightest stuff is probably stars, and these little smudges are probably mainly galaxies. And so what do you do with this? Well, so you look at that and you say, huh, what do you make of that? And so with the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, you can do a more complicated version, which is to say you can look much deeper. And here they've removed all the stars, and now we're looking at a big chunk of the sky. So this is, together, these two maps constitute something like a quarter of the sky. And then you look at that and you say, what can we do with that? So is that a random distribution? So it depends on exactly which galaxies you're looking at. So some of them you just see that they're, so there's a whole algorithm for star galaxy separation where there are entire graduate careers. There are armies of graduate students that have written theses on star galaxy separation. The simplest version is you just say, if it looks like a dot, we're going to throw it out. So if it's not spatially resolved, we're going to just throw it out and assume that it's a star, because you expect a galaxy is going to be, you know, galaxy-sized. And so if we can't see that it's extended, let's just throw it out. So that's the simplest version. The problem with that is you are then biased against certain types of galaxies. So for instance, you would never see quasars. So quasars stands for quasi-stellar radio object. And it's quasi-stellar because they were finding these bright radio sources, and when you looked at them in the optical, they just looked like white dwarfs. They were just a blue dot. So if you only use the spatial information, you end up throwing out all sorts of other clues. So the next step is to then use what color it is. So whether it's red, whether it's blue, and exactly how blue is it, how red is it, and we know roughly what stars look like, and you say, does it look like a star? And so the various levels are, if it looks like a galaxy, yes, it's a galaxy. If it doesn't look like a star, it's probably a galaxy. And then you just sort of descend so these days, most of them work in some Bayesian way where you just have priors on what you think it is based on what you're looking at. And so exactly how reliable that is depends on basically the personal tastes of the person running the algorithm. And so generally, for a large-scale structure survey, they'll be extremely conservative. They'll just avoid anything that looks like it could possibly be a star. And the thing that saves you, so it turns out that this problem is getting easier with time. It's one of the only things in the world that is getting easier the more carefully you look. And the reason for that is because as you go deeper and deeper, you actually pick up galaxies. So there are many, many more faint galaxies than there are faint stars. And it's just because there's an edge to our galaxy. So as you're looking out, once you're seeing most of the stars, then you go a little fainter, you've already seen all the stars, and you're just going to start picking up more and more galaxies. So as our surveys are looking deeper and deeper at fainter and fainter objects, they're becoming increasingly dominated by stars. And it's now the case where, with Sloan, if you just take the bottom, if you throw out the top 90% or something of objects, you just rank order them by flux, and you say the 90% brightest things I'm just going to throw out, they will be overwhelmingly stars. And then whatever's left will be at 95% galaxies. So it turns out that you could act, an easy way to do it is if it's bright, throw it out. But so these galaxies typically go to about a, so Sloan would go to redshift typically 0.2 or something like that. And so a galaxy is usually a few kiloparsecs, and that's what Andromeda is as well. And so now we have to do some math. So in general, what we learned is that there's some Hubble relation, right? That the distance is of order h naught times the redshift and CH inverse. And so this is about 3,000 megaparsecs. And so if you go to 0.2, so d of z of 0.2, well, let's call it 0.33 so that we know that it's about a megaparsec. That's about 1,000 megaparsecs. And then you need to know that Andromeda M31 is at a distance of just less than 1 megaparsec. So that tells you that these galaxies would typically be about 1/1,000th the size of Andromeda. So that says that so the typical angular size, which is some L over the distance, is going to be about 1/1,000th, however big Andromeda is. So it's degree scale. So if this is of order a degree, so 1 degree is 60 arc minutes, just 3,600 arc seconds. So what you see is it's going to be typically a few arc seconds. So the order of magnitude is that there'll be, you know, 3-4 arc seconds. What's the resolution? It's about 1. So in general, for a telescope on the ground, unless it's really small, you're limited by atmospheric seeing. And atmospheric seeing at a mid-range site is somewhere around an arc second. So the Sloan survey is not at a great site. So the, if you look at a picture of the Sloan telescope, you see trees in the picture, which is always a bad sign, because it means there's moisture and such. So the seeing at Sloan is probably a little more than 1 arc second, but it's not 2. And if you look at something like Subaru is the Japanese telescope, they're getting seeing of like a third of an arc second. And then if you want to do adaptive optics on top of that, then you could, but it doesn't work very, it doesn't work for surveys. If you want to do adaptive optics, you do it object by object. Okay, so a typical galaxy is a few arc seconds. And this whole thing, what we're looking at here, you know, this is a quarter of the sky. So this is just basically the number density of galaxies. And then you look at this, and then you say, is that a random distribution? And so now you need to figure out some way to characterize whether some distribution is random or not. And there are lots of ways to do it. There's no unique way to say, is some distribution random? So you could think of ways of doing it. Like you could put circles down, and you could count how many objects are in each circle. And you'll get a slightly different answer in every circle, because even if it was just pure white noise, you would just expect Poisson noise in the number of galaxies in any one circle you put down. So the question is it random? How random is it? Because you know that there's always going to be some jitter. And so the first thing people did, and it's actually what people still do a lot of, are correlation functions. And so it's a simple idea, which is you just say, if I pick some random galaxy, or I pick a random spot right here, how likely am I to see some object next to it compared to random? So you can define some two-point correlation function, which says the number of pairs at some separation is just some mean number squared, just from some random number, and I guess that would be over 2, times 1 plus something. So this is just a way to parameterize your ignorance and say, I'm going to look in here and I'm just going to count up pairs of hits. And everywhere I see 2 pairs, I'm going to just throw that into the list as being at some separation. And so this is telling us something about how random it is. And so if it was completely random and it was just completely dominated by just Poisson noise in the counts, what I would expect is that this W of theta is 0. So you can do that. And that's what Jim Peebles did. He said, and so this was in the 70s, he just said, I'm just going to put down a circle right here, and I'm going to say, how many galaxies are there in a ring right here? And then I'm going to move to the next point and count up all the rings, and the next point, count up all the galaxies, and do that at every theta. And that should be something that's roughly 0 if it's completely random. And what else could it be? And what he found was something that looked like this. So this is the excess probability of finding a neighbor at this separation. And what you find is that as you get to close separations, you can be 10 times more likely than average. So at 0.03 degrees, he found it was 10 times more likely to find a neighbor than just random. And so that was in 1975, and this was for 2 different samples. So he looked at 2 different sets of galaxies, and he found that these ones were only maybe half again as likely, which is to say that there was some random chance of seeing stuff, and then you add a half to that. And it's also the case that this thing could go negative. And in fact, it does go negative. If you put in some constraint that everything has to be normalized, you end up with, there must be somewhere where this thing goes negative, or else you'll end up with too many pairs. So this was in 1975. So in 2002, using something very similar to that data I just showed you, here's the same plot, and it's W of theta versus theta in degrees. And so this is using the Sloan galaxies, and these are just different brightnesses. So depending on which galaxies I use, do I use kind of bright ones or really faint ones? What you find is that this thing, first of all, looks very close to a power law, which is interesting in its own right. But also, you see there's a very strong excess on small scales. So that says that galaxies are clumped. So that's interesting. Now we know galaxies are clumped. So what do we do with this? Well, so another thing you could do with this, what did we do with maps like this when they were CMB maps? Well, the first thing we did was take the harmonic transform. We took it and we turned it into CL. So you can do the exact same thing with this map. So it's just a galaxy number density map. And you can just take CL of that, and you can do the exact same thing. And this is L plus 1 CL over 2 pi versus multiple Ls. So this is exactly what we saw in the case of for the CMB power spectrum. And now what you see is you see something that's rising towards small scales. And again, you see that it, depending on which bins you look at, whether you look at bright stuff or faint stuff, the clustering strength is different. So the bright stuff, which is this stuff here, is much more strongly clustered, something like a factor of 2 more clustered than the faint stuff. So that tells us that galaxies are clustered. That's good. Now, what's the relationship between these two things? So you could say, oh, well, that's 2 different ways of doing things. Which one's right, or which one's better? Now, if you think about exactly how you went about doing this, so for W of theta, you went out and you counted pairs, which means you did, for every galaxy, you found another galaxy, and you took those 2 things, and you then said 1 galaxy times 1 galaxy. That's a 2-point function. And you think about how you would calculate an angular power spectrum. Well, that's CL is that ALM squared. So ALM means you visit each galaxy once, and you throw it into each ALM. And then you're squaring that, or you're multiplying it by the complex conjugate, which means you visit every galaxy again, and you throw it into the sum, and then you multiply those 2 things together. That's another 2-point function. So in fact, these two things are the exact same. That what you can show is that the two-point correlation function, that this W of theta is the Fourier transform, or sorry, the angular transform. So it's the YLM transform of CL. So it means that they're just, if you can do it in one space, you can do it in the other. And there's just a, and so this, you know, it's a harmonic transform is a linear operation. So it means you just take the same data and you shuffle it around with different weights and you end up with something else. And so you can either take W of theta and turn it into a CL if you wanted, or you could take a CL and turn it into a W of theta, but it's the exact same information and it's just a different way of plotting it. So it took a while before people figured out that they were all doing the same thing. People were arguing. Some people were saying it was better to do it as a harmonic space thing. Some people said W of theta. And eventually it was shown that if you do it extremely carefully, there's nothing to worry about. And so it's also true in position space. So in 3D, instead of an angle, so the in 3D, the equivalent of this is the two-point correlation function in 3D. And that is basically the Fourier transform of P of K. So now I know you guys spent time learning about P of K last week. So this is the matter power spectrum. Or it's, so this would be the so if this is for the matter, this would be the for the matter power spectrum. And it's the same thing. It's just if you define this thing right here as saying, what's the excess probability of finding mass within some distance of some other bit of mass, that's the two-point correlation function. And that's just the Fourier transform of the matter power spectrum. So it's the same information, just a different way of looking at it. Yep.
Is there a reason why the bright text is more
solid color? Ah, well, yes. So why are those more strongly clustered? Well, that's this thing called galaxy bias. And so this was a mystery for, you know, in the 80s, there was this problem in that, well, so what people realize is that you have this thing, you have things that are clustered four different ways, but you know that there's only one underlying density field. So you have one density field, and what you would hope is that the galaxies are just populating the density field in some easy to understand way. But if one of them has double the clustering strength of the other, only they can't both be tracing the same density field. So something has to be going on. And what was figured out by Nick Kaiser was this idea of peaks bias, or and the way it works is that if you hypothesize something which is quite reasonable, which is that let's say that galaxies only form at the high peaks of the density field. So you have some random density field, you have peaks and valleys, and if there's some process at work such that the galaxies only form where the peaks in the density field are sufficiently high to exceed some threshold. So if that's the starting assumption, that you just say galaxies only form at peaks above some threshold. So here's the threshold, and there's the peak. So, and then what we're going to do is we're going to say, we're going to take some very long wavelength fluctuations. So, and when I say long wavelength, what I'm talking about are in this picture right here, imagine that I have fluctuations on scales of maybe this, and I'm saying that whatever it is that causes galaxies to form is subpixel. So galaxy formation is some subgrid effect that we have no hope of understanding, but it has something to do with how dense things are. And then the idea is that if I have some long wavelength modulation like this, and on top of that, I have some small scale noise that looks like this, and I then threshold this thing, and I say, I'm only going to put galaxies in the highest peaks, what's going to happen is that I'm going to end up clipping this field so that at this point right here, I'll put down three galaxies. So I'll put three galaxies here, and I'll put no galaxies down here, and then I'll put three galaxies here. And so what's going to happen is that as I raise this threshold higher and higher, all of my galaxies are going to end up clumping together right at the very highest peaks. So if I lower this threshold down to here, so first of all, if I put the threshold down here, I'll get all the peaks. So I move it up like this, and you know, if I put my threshold down here, I'll just form galaxies everywhere, and I'll just get galaxies all over the place, and it'll be hard to see the large scale modulation at all. But with this high peak threshold, I get this idea that I only see big clumps right at the very highest peaks. And as I raise that threshold, it's only going to pick out these peaks more and more. So the higher my threshold, the more clumped my galaxies will be. And this is this idea of peaks bias. And what it means is that if I'm then trying to look at the large scale structure on the scale of this dotted line, if I want to say how much clustering power is there on this scale right here, the higher I put my threshold, the more I'm going to enhance the clumpiness in that field. And so then it just comes down to saying, well, the bigger the galaxy is, surely the more rare that thing has to be. So if you say big galaxies are more rare than faint galaxies, then you end up with this idea that the threshold for forming them must be higher, and so rare stuff ends up automatically being more strongly biased relative to the density field. But it's still going to be the case that your galaxies are only going to appear at the peaks in your density field. So it means that you still have galaxies that are roughly tracing the large-scale structure, that I'm not getting galaxies randomly throughout here. I'm getting galaxies at the peaks, which is what I want. But the higher my threshold, the more the galaxies will be represented there, and the stronger the contrast is going to be. And that's exactly what you see right here, is that the larger the galaxies are, the more strongly clustered they are. And the assumption is that they're all tracing the same underlying field. Now, there's problems with this. And so, first of all, it's a little bit hand-wavy to say, well, let's just assume that it's all happening on such a small scale that we don't really care what's going on, which is to say, we're not going to worry about the details of exactly why the galaxies form here. Because you could imagine that maybe a galaxy would form here and would shoot out all sorts of UV radiation and somehow shut all these other ones down, and that would ruin this view. So there's, questions of implementation of, is this actually a reasonable model for how galaxies populate the matter distribution in the universe? Yep.
How will Freeman related to the sample wave formation
yesterday? What was that?
With the
acoustic oscillations, yeah. Those will also be involved. So those acoustic oscillations on this scale, so those would count as an extra one of these long wavelength modulations. Those acoustic modulations on the scale of galaxies are still quite large. So the CMB is in general a large scale effect as compared to galaxies. But that's all part of the same story, is that those acoustic oscillations will show up as modulating this background density field. Now, functionally, a problem that this introduces is that the overall amplitude of the galaxy clustering becomes incredibly difficult to understand. Because here's this power spectrum, and which one's right? We know that the heaviest things are biased, and probably there's some set in here that's not biased very much, but it's impossible to know which one's the right answer. So if all you do is measure the amplitude of clustering in galaxies, you actually have no idea what the intrinsic amplitude of the matter clustering is. And so the only thing that you can predict is the clustering of matter. You can't predict the clustering of the galaxies without some detailed understanding of how galaxies form. So one direction the cosmology has gone is that lots of people are trying to figure out exactly how to turn this into something more realistic and figuring out exactly where galaxies would form in some realistic view of the universe. And generally that's built on simulations. All right. So all of this is just talking about how to, so we have this thing, but without some guide, I would argue that without some theory expectation, your data is useless, just as, theory without data, as many say, are useless. I think data without theory is also useless because, you could fit anything. So what do we expect to see? Well, this is what you learned all about last week, which is you expect that this, so this is CL, and this is all angular, but we can also go into 3D. So here's a 3D version of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. And what I've done is I've taken a version of that same data, and I didn't do it, they did it. An angle would be this way. So, and it's just some slice through the data in some direction. So this would be some angle. And this direction is redshift. And it's not distance, it's redshift. And then what you can do is you go back to your mapping between co-moving distance and redshift. So at low redshift, it's just linear. But remember, we calculated that we had that R of Z for any cosmology, which means you take that thing and you just invert it, and you get Z of R, and then you measure the redshift, the spectroscopic redshift, and then you put it some distance from the center based on its redshift. So in this case, it's been done, it's linear because it's all relatively nearby, so it's an easy thing to do for nearby stuff because it's just a nice linear relation. But as you get further away, you have to account for the changing co-moving distance as a function of redshift. And so what you're using is redshift as a proxy for distance. And when you do that, you now have a 3D map of the universe. That's neat. The problem with that is that when you measure the spectrum of something, it's not only coming from the cosmological expansion, it's also true that any one galaxy out there could be moving slightly. So there's going to be a Doppler shift. And that Doppler shift, so if that was just completely random, that'd be no problem. However, if you have a big lump of galaxies right here, and let's say we're down there looking up, and you have another galaxy there, this galaxy here is going to tend to be getting pulled into this big one, just because it's going to start to fall in. So structure formation means that stuff right here is going to have a tendency to fall in, and stuff on the front side is going to have a tendency to fall in, which means the velocity of this is going to be systematically biased such that there's a cosmological expansion moving away, but it's going to have its own peculiar velocity, is what it's called, is this excess that's going to be a little bit negative, and it has a tendency to clump things up along the line of sight. So when you, so this is a simulation, but in, you see it in the real data. So this is distance, and this is real space, angle versus distance in some wedge. And you see it look, you know, that there could be some filamentary structure, and you could do a W, you could do a two-point correlation function on this and identify structures. But when you do the same thing in velocity space, just take this mapping right here and estimate the distance based on its redshift, what happens is you get things clumping up, you get things that are sort of linear along this direction right here. So you see this, these things are clumping up this way. And you also find this odd effect that things start to get pointed towards the observer. And so people referred to these as fingers of God, because it was a little weird that everywhere you looked, everything was pointed right at you. So you have these great walls in the perpendicular direction and these fingers of God that are pointed towards us. And it took some head scratching to figure out what was going on. And so what's going on is just exactly this idea of the peculiar velocities being correlated with the large-scale structure. So in this case right here, the cosmological redshift of this thing is clearly going to be lower than the cosmological redshift of this thing because they're further away. So you're seeing this thing at an earlier time when the universe was smaller. And so therefore, this thing will have more of a cosmological redshift than this thing just because there's a finite light travel time from here to here. Similarly, on the backside, this one has taken even longer to get to us, so the cosmological expansion has been even larger, so therefore this one will have a yet larger cosmological redshift. However, on top of that cosmological redshift, this thing right here should have less of a redshift, except that it's falling into this, which enhances its redshift a little bit and makes this thing a little bit closer to this in redshift than you would expect. Similarly, this thing right here is falling in, which will slightly counteract. So this one's being blue shifted. So that'll slightly counteract that cosmological redshift, and it causes things to clump up. And so that's why you get this tendency for these sheets to form in the transverse direction. The fingers of God come from the end point of this process, which is you imagine what happens once these things have fallen in. So this thing falls in, this thing falls in. They have some amount of angular momentum, and then they start orbiting around. So you then have some distribution of stuff that's all moving in random directions. And it's moving in some random directions. And as you see it, you'll see objects that will be spread out a little bit. But because it's all collapsed into three dimensions, it's now much more compact. And what you see is that at this one space, you'll see some stuff moving in, some stuff moving out, some stuff here moving out, some stuff here moving in. And the net result is that you're seeing just the superposition of a bunch of random velocities all at one spot. And so at that spot, you're going to see some smear in velocities. So it's not so much that it's pointing at us, so much as at this point right here, so find one of these things, what's happened is you have some very large bound object, and what's happening is there's some range in velocities that's completely uncorrelated with that all those things share the same cosmological redshift to zeroth order. They're all very close to each other spatially, but they have random velocities just from peculiar velocity, just from this internal velocity. So that's what these fingers of God are. Now, at first, this was just thought to be an annoyance. And I would say for most of the history of galaxy surveys, most people have said, that sucks. This is just causing our life to be much more difficult. But what's happened is that we now observe this. And so here is data from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. This is the BOSS survey. This is a zoom in on the central region. And what we're plotting now is the two-point correlation function. So it's how many pairs you're finding at various separations. So it's basically taking this thing right here, and if you do a two-point correlation function on this, what you're going to find is that an object right here is going to have many more objects in this direction close to it than it has in this direction. And similarly in the walls, you'll have a tendency for things to be clustered in this parallel direction. And so that shows up in the two-point correlation function. And so you get this finger of God that's pointed straight at us. And then you have, in general, the whole correlation structure gets squished by things that are infalling. And you might think that this is really annoying, that you used to have this nice, perfectly symmetric correlation function in position space. But the amount of this squishing is directly telling you the rate at which structure is starting to fall in, which means not only can you measure where stuff is, you're also getting a sense of its dynamical history. So you're not just doing a snapshot of where everything is, you're also getting another indicator of what it's doing. You're measuring its position and its speed of all this stuff that's falling in, and that's a direct probe of how gravity is pulling stuff together. So if you have some alternative theory of gravity that has slightly different interactions on scales of that are mildly cosmological, that will show up in exactly a measurement like this. So this has turned out to be one of the best probes of gravity on this intermediate scales that's between scales of individual galaxies or the solar system or the universe. It's actually this intermediate scale, and it provides a real new handle on physics. However, so regardless of the flattening, so the flattening is nice to measure, but we also have the radial dependence. And so the radial dependence is just telling us the two-point correlation function, which is directly telling us this P of K. So remember, so I asked some people and they promised me that they recognized what P of K was. So you take this 3D thing and we can now measure P of K versus K, which looks like this, where this is the matter clustering. And so inflation tells us that it should look something like this. However, there is another problem, which is that this, so let's look at this thing right here, and hopefully what you see is some very bright splotches and some truly empty ones. And what does that mean? That means that this has fluctuations of order unity or larger, maybe even fluctuations that are 10. And so what you know is that linear theory is not going to be valid anymore. And so on the scale that you're seeing this thing right here, this density field has gone nonlinear. And you can, when you see these filaments all over the place and these voids in between, it means you're dealing with a nonlinear density field. And when it's, so this is the linear theory power spectrum. So the thing that you can produce coming out of inflation is the linear theory power spectrum. And the thing that you heard last week about the theory, probably effective field theory of large-scale structure, so that will be able to take a small piece of the nonlinear power spectrum and make it more linear. But if instead of, so the linear power spectrum should look like this. If instead I just took the power spectrum of that data, what you're going to find is something that looks kind of like this. And so this is the nonlinear power spectrum. And maybe I can do something to sort of recover this quasi-linear regime with a lot of work. And there are good reasons for doing that because, as we'll see in a second, this region where it starts to go nonlinear is right around the BAO scale. So maybe you want to do some work. But in general, you're just fundamentally stuck by this idea that on very small scales, your whole density field has gone nonlinear. So what do people do with this? So this nonlinear scale is going, in general, your density field is evolving. So if I plot k cubed p of k versus k, so at very early times, so that's what this thing is right here. This is k cubed p of k versus k, and this is at early times. This is the linear power spectrum at early times, slightly later times, even later, even later. What you find is this thing is evolving upwards in time, which is to say that structure is growing. So large-scale structure is growing with time. As we go forward in time, we're going up. And if you put a threshold right here at contrast of order one, you get that the nonlinear scale for the first objects is way down here. Galaxies, they go nonlinear at a lower redshift. Today, it's galaxy clusters that are going nonlinear. What the nonlinear scale is, so today the scale is around 0.1. At earlier times, the nonlinear scale could be way out here at a much higher k. Now, people model this. They spend a lot of time modeling this as a halo model. And I'm just telling you this so that when you sit in on your next large-scale structure talk, you'll know what they're talking about. Here is a version of the nonlinear power spectrum right here. If you run an n-body simulation, and you plot k cubed p of k versus k, you see this thing in the n-body simulation goes up like this. This is the matter power spectrum. Linear theory says it should just go like this. So a remarkably efficient way of getting some curve that reasonably closely matches this is to say, I'm going to put in a cut where I assume that I have my density field, and I'm just going to assume that there's basically two types of correlations in the universe, that all the fluctuations in all the mass density in the universe, I'm going to say, is fragmented into dark matter halos. And then I'm going to say that there are galaxies that trace these dark matter halos. So imagine some chocolate chip cookies, but not too much because it's almost time for lunch. And then as I measure correlations, there's going to be two flavors of correlations. So one flavor of correlation between galaxies are going to be pairs like this that are between halos. And those will invariably be large separations. So large separations in k-space corresponds to low k. So at low k, all of my large-scale structure is composed of pairs that generally are going to span halos. So all of my pairs that are this long must be necessarily coming from things that are in two separate halos. And so in that case, it doesn't really matter to me whether these individual pairs are distributed as chocolate chip cookies or whether they're distributed as dots down here at the center. Then in general, the distribution of these chocolate chips doesn't really matter very much. All that really matters is the distribution of these halos. And that model of galaxy biasing said that the halos are distributed in a way that's roughly still tracing the large-scale structure. So these cookies trace the large-scale structure. So on large scales, I can use the chocolate chips and everything's fine. On small scales, if I then say I'm looking for correlations that are this far apart, I'm always going to be getting stuff that's within the same halo. That there just simply aren't any halos that are close enough where I ever get some correlations that are this long. And so the small scale structure gets dominated by things that are within a halo. The large scale structure gets dominated by just the distribution of halos, which should trace linear theory. On small scales, all I'm getting is the density profile of dark matter halos. And so there's this thing called a halo model, where you basically, you say, well, all of the small scale structure out here is determined by the density profiles within the halos. And so this is all one halo out here, whereas the large scale structure is determined by correlations between two halos. That's called the two halo term. So there's a two halo and a one halo term. And you can use that to model the entire nonlinear power spectrum. Now, most of the theory, the only solid theory is out here in the two halo term. Once you get down into here, you're learning about how galaxies populate dark matter halos. All right. So we also talked yesterday about these sound waves in the universe, where at every point around every CMB fluctuation, you get these sound waves propagating out. And here is a graphic version of this from Dan Eisenstein. And so what this is the profile of some perturbation as a function of radius. So this is just a slice through that movie I showed yesterday. And so you start with some clump of dark matter. So this is at 14,000 years, so a redshift of something like 6,000. And what you see is you see that you had some clump of dark matter, and then you had some gas, and the photons were coupled to the gas. So the gas and photons are here. So you're seeing this acoustic wave propagating out. The neutrinos have just been free streaming out of the potential wells for a long time because they're relativistic and they just go streaming out. And since they're going at roughly c, and this is going at 1 over root 3 c, you see the neutrinos are beating the photons out. But so you just started with some big lump right here and you just see what happens. You see this pressure wave propagating out. So here we are a little bit later. So the neutrinos kept on going. The dark matter has now grown. So notice that the axis is going up, right? So it's 20, now it's 60. That's saying that the dark matter perturbation is now a little larger than it was. The photon perturbation is also a little bit larger, and it's also moving out. And here it is again at 0.57 megayears. So here's at a redshift of 500. So this was at 1440. This was right before decoupling. So what happened is from here to here, the photons and the gas decoupled. So the gas stopped moving out because there was no longer this photon pressure driving it. So the gas stalls right here, and the photons then start just streaming across the universe, which means they just go streaming out of this perturbation. The neutrinos keep on going all the way across the universe. The dark matter continues to grow. The dark matter continues to grow. You have this lump of gas that's sitting right here. It starts to clump up due to self-gravity. The photons keep streaming out. Some of the gas is now falling back into the central potential. So you have some gas is falling back into the dark matter in the center, but you also have that some of the dark matter is falling into the excess gravity of the gas. And so this continues, and you get to redshift 10. By the time you get to redshift 10, you have almost all the gas is returned to the center of this halo, but you still have this remnant out here that has grown. And so you now have a clump of dark matter and gas out here and a clump of dark matter gas here and here. So even though you started with just a single density perturbation in the dark matter right here, you now have two lumps separated by about 150 megaparsecs. So that means that everywhere you look and you see some lump of dark matter or even a galaxy, you should have a much higher probability than average of finding a galaxy 150 megaparsecs away, because for everything that formed, for every dark matter lump that's here, there should be a smaller dark matter lump some distance away. And this is what's known as the baryon acoustic oscillation peak. And what's nice about this is that we measure what this distance should be using the cosmic microwave background, which means if we ever can measure this secondary peak in the galaxy distribution, that means that we actually have a ruler, and we can use that at all different redshifts to figure out exactly how far away things are. So this was done. So in 2005, I think, was when this was clearly detected by the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. And so this is this two-point correlation function. So it's the number of pairs of some separation as a function of separation. And lo and behold, if you squint, you can see that there's a dot, there's some excess here. So this is not the most compelling data in the world, but it's still the case that it's hard to imagine that, there's not at least a couple data points that are high. And so that's improved over time. So here's the most recent version, 2013. So this is this two-point correlation function versus separation. And lo and behold, what you see is a clear peak in the galaxy distribution. And this is the BAO scale. And so what that says is that, so this was done at, so I don't know which redshift this one is, but for this particular redshift, it says that we measure these angles and line of sight velocities, and when we convert that into distances, we can see this clear peak. So that means that we now know the distance, the correspond, the co-moving distance to this redshift extremely well. So it's a standard ruler. And so what people have used this for is to do exactly what they've done with supernovae. You can plot distance versus redshift. And so this background stuff right here are supernovae. So this is what was used to characterize the equation of state of dark energy and to show that dark energy exists. And now, instead of using supernovae, these exploding white dwarfs that seem remarkably uniform for reasons that we're not quite sure of, we can now use the acoustic scale of the cosmic microwave background imprinted in the galaxies as a ruler to set down at all different redshifts. And so here are, this is a fairly up-to-date of all the different ways people have done this. So SDSS. So the one I just showed you was BOSS, so that must be this one right here. But what you see is you see that compared to the supernova, these things are much more precise. And in fact, in statistical weight, the two are right now fairly comparable. But it also means that we can extend this out to higher redshift. You see there's a point out here at redshift 2, whereas the most distant supernova known is at redshift 1.4. So anywhere we can measure galaxy clustering, we can measure this distance. So it's sort of it's a new idea for ways to chart distance versus redshift, and it should allow us to get new handles on dark energy.
So you're saying the dark energy profile depends on the dark matter profile?
Yes. Well, to some extent. I mean, the thing is that acoustic scale is mainly just a pressure wave. And so we're using the fact that the dark matter is going to end up, you have this pressure wave, and the main point is that the baryons are getting swept up in this pressure wave, and that whenever that pressure wave stalls, the baryons are going to get left there. And that's going to accrete both dark matter and normal mass, and it just means you're going to end up with some scale that's going to have, inevitably gravity is going to amplify correlations on that scale. And so it doesn't really matter very much what the details of the dark matter are. It really is just saying that as long as there is the scale that's been imprinted, that scale will inevitably get amplified by gravity in such a way that we should see in the galaxy distribution. And that's what this is saying. And then so the details of exactly how well it fits the models and getting the models to, the relative amplitudes of these peaks and things like that, that'll depend on the details of dark matter. But just this ruler, the existence of this ruler is really just saying that we have these sound, that there are sound waves we saw in the CMB that also carried baryons out with them.
Are they likely to get up to an even larger redshift?
Now, yes. So, we should be able to get to about a redshift of, I think, 3.5 or something like that, using more, using Lyman break galaxies, I think. So basically, if you just do a survey what's happening right here is this is Lyman alpha, which is a UV line, and that's redshifting into the optical band. And eventually that goes through the optical band into the infrared, but that doesn't happen until redshift 6. So in principle, all you need to do is just go looking very carefully for the Lyman alpha line, and you could use the Lyman alpha line as an indicator of where there are galaxies. And so if you had a deep enough survey that could detect Lyman alpha from a whole bunch of galaxies, you could do this. Now, it turns out that sort of currently it craps out around redshift of about 3.5. But there's this thing, HETDEX is being built down in Texas. And that's what they're trying to do, is do this Hubble diagram at redshift 3. So a nice sort of compilation of trying to understand exactly how all these things fit together is to take this P of K that is predicted from inflation and just throw all of the probes on here that we know about. So this is a version from this. It's crazy. This is from like 2002 or something like that. And here's the cosmic microwave background. And it hasn't gotten much better out here because this is all large scales where after WMAP, everything was cosmic variance limited on large scales. And then galaxies are in green. And there's clusters on here. Weak lensing, which we'll talk about later, fills in here. And then Lyman Alpha Forest is clustering in the in absorbers in front of quasars, but it's basically just another way of doing a galaxy survey in a weird way. And what you see is that this P of K is incredibly well mapped out. And so it's over, you know, four decades or something like that. It really confirms this inflationary paradigm extremely well. It looks like a very close to scale invariant spectrum. So a more recent version of this is from 2012. But I think it's one of these things where, so first of all, the color helps. But it's also true that the error bars are now so small that it's not interesting anymore. You know, what was nice about this is you got to see all the colors because of the big error bars. Whereas now the error bars have been shrunk to the point where it's harder to see it. So this is in P of K. So you can see some ripple in this right here. So if you take that baryon acoustic oscillation and you Fourier transform it, you end up with some rippling right here, in the same way that the acoustic peaks of the CMB have these ripples to them. Okay, now, so I'll just close with some inspiration for why we might want to do this if you don't care about inflation or where all the structure in the universe came from. So if you really just wanted to get your name in the particle data book, what would you want to do? Well, one way you could get your name in the particle data book is by measuring the mass of neutrinos. Because right now, we don't actually know what neutrinos weigh. But this is something that we can do in cosmology. And you could see that in that baryon acoustic oscillation plot where you saw the neutrinos streaming out of the potentials. So the neutrinos are broadly relativistic, but they're not completely relativistic. So what we know is that there's a lower limit to neutrino masses of 0.05 eV. And the temperature of the universe today is below 10 to the minus 4 eV. So what that says is that you know that today neutrinos are non-relativistic. At least one of them is a non-relativistic particle, which means it can get trapped in large-scale structure just like everything else. So if you say how much energy density is there in neutrinos, so you could do, so if the neutrinos were all 0.1 eV, or if there was one neutrino that was 0.1 eV, it would contribute 0.002 for a Hubble constant of 70. That's what that means. So 0.2% to omega for a single 0.1 eV neutrino. So it's not very much, but it's not zero. Like, remember those error bars on Planck? I mean, cosmology is now in a regime where 0.2% is no longer a scary number. Now, neutrinos are particularly interesting, though, because, you know, on small scales, they act like radiation. And that's just saying that if you have a high enough velocity, you'll just go zipping out of any potential around. That if you have a very small potential, the neutrinos are not bound to that. But if you have a big enough potential, the neutrinos can fall into it. And for masses around 0.1 eV, that's right about where neutrinos start getting captured into galaxy clusters. So on large enough scales, the neutrinos will start acting like matter. So you have this thing, this sort of it's not particle wave duality, it's matter radiation duality, where it depends on whether you're looking on small scales or large scales, whether you should count neutrinos as being like photons or being like cold dark matter. And they do this transition in this regime where we can actually measure it. So galaxy clusters are not a crazy scale, which means we could actually look for this transition of where stuff stops acting like matter and starts acting like radiation. So in units of this P of K, so compared to the P of K with a massless neutrino, so this is P of K for neutrinos versus P of K with no neutrinos. So scaling out this overall dependence, saying how big is the effect of massive neutrinos, What you find is that if the sum of the neutrino masses is 100 millielectron volts, that's 0.1 eV, so 50 millielectron volts is what we know is the floor. So the sum of the neutrinos, so since one of them has to be 0.05 just from the neutrino oscillation experiments, we know that compared to a universe with no neutrinos in it at all, the structure needs to be suppressed on scales of, say, k of 0.1 to 1 by almost 5%. So there should be 5% less clustering power on small scales just from this 0.05 eV neutrino. And so if instead of it being a 0.05 eV neutrino, there's, say, 2.05 eV neutrinos, that would be an inverted hierarchy, then you're up here at 100 millielectron volts, and then you're down there. And you would say, how is it possible that you're not noticing 10% effects in the matter power spectrum, given that you just told me that 0.2% is not a scary number? And the problem is this galaxy bias, that in when you're doing galaxy clustering studies, because we don't know the overall amplitude, we can't actually use the overall amplitude as any bit of information. All we can use is the relative shape information. And so if you go back to this plot right here, you know, in this range right here, what we're looking for is differences of a few percent in the shape information through here, but you see that we're bridging together different probes, that the galaxies are kind of running out, so the CMB is running out of steam here, the galaxies are pretty good in there, but they start to run out of steam on large scales. So it's kind of, you have to stitch together a bunch of different probes in order to be able to get the scale dependence right. However, that's what we can do now, is stitch together probes. And so what you can say is, you can say, how well should we do? And if you do the next generation CMB experiment from the ground, so basically you say, we have Planck in hand, we do the next generation CMB experiment, and that should nail down all sorts of stuff that we need. And then DESI, which is sort of a five-year timescale spectroscopic survey that people have planned. So sort of the next generation big galaxy survey in the US. What we project is that we should be able to get to the point where our 68% uncertainty will be 16 millielectron volts. So to put that in perspective, Katrine, which is doing this in labs and actually measuring things like the mass of the electron neutrino in more direct ways, they're hoping to one day get down here to, say, 0.2 eV. And it's currently up above 1 eV. Current cosmology, just sort of just the zeroth order idiot check, which says, well, okay, you know, look at this thing. How much could the scale dependence be? And you know, once you get down here, it's pretty obvious it's not there, right? So our current idiot check is something around 0.3 eV, I believe. Yeah, 0.3 eV says, well, if it was much more than 0.3 eV, then nothing would work properly. So you just can't have the scale dependence at the 20% level. So we know that the sum of the neutrino masses from cosmology can't be more than about 0.3 eV. And then the question is, what's the answer going to be? So we know that the sum of the neutrinos has to be at least 0.05 eV, which is right here. So if all that happened is you had one neutrino that was 0.05, and then that was the one heavy one, and then you had another one which was basically massless, and then one in between that's close to massless, then you would end up right here. And that's what people call the normal hierarchy. If instead you had one light one and two heavy ones, so if the small splitting was between the two heavy ones, you'd have the inverted hierarchy, then you're up here at 0.1 eV. And what you see is that, you know, so depending on what the measurement's going to be, future cosmology with this 16 milli eV error bar, if it really is the normal hierarchy, we'll be able to pretty clearly rule out this inverted hierarchy just by saying we've measured the mass to be, you know, 50 millielectron volts plus or minus 16, and that clearly is going to rule out this inverted hierarchy. So, you know, there are spots where you could be in trouble, like say if you're you know, these curves start to get close to each other right around here. So it's possible that we could land somewhere out here where it could be either the inverted hierarchy or the normal hierarchy, in which case we'll need Katrine to move down by another factor of 10, which they probably wouldn't enjoy. But that's the kind of, that's other reasons to do cosmology other than inflation.
What's the time scale of future cosmology, green and future cosmology?
So current cosmology is, that's where we are. These two things are the same, it's the same error bar in two different spots just because it's a log scale. So in proposal land, these will be done in 2020.
So the same as Katrine, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the way it was sort of, so yeah. So I guess these are proposal land as well. But in proposal land, you know, they're going to get to the point where we think that's already impossible. So, you know, it's interesting. So interesting times ahead. So for graduate students, so this will be, I guess, for you guys, it'll be when you're partway through your postdocs. So maybe it's not what you should be working on right now. All right. So I hope I've convinced you that clustering of galaxies has a lot going on. It's extremely rich. There's all sorts of things going on. And clustering of galaxies means a lot of things. There's baryon acoustic oscillations, which you can use as a standard ruler. There are these redshift space distortions, which you can use to probe gravity. And also, we're hoping to measure the neutrino masses in the next, you know, 5 years in proposal land, which is probably more like 7 or 8 years in the real world. But still, that's pretty good. I mean, it's pretty exciting that that's where we're headed. All right, so let's get some lunch.